So what's the name of this podcast?
Eugene
Cast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
Oig Cast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to Huge Cast.
That's right. You're listening to Huge Cast, a volunteer-powered cooperative where we talk with people who may or may not live in the Eugene, Oregon area. We think they have some really cool stories to tell. So buckle up, Buttercup. It starts now.
Hi, my name's Adam Wendt, and I am here with Herb Pendleton, or Herbert.
Just call me Herb.
Herb Pendleton. Herb has lived here in the Eugene area for about 17, going on 18 years. He is a parent of many, an active participant in the local social justice, school communities, and education. Well, Herb, once again, thanks. And so, you lived in New York when?
I was actually born in New Jersey, and my mom brought us over to New York when I was four. So in 1940, I was born. 1944 or so, I moved to New York. When we moved into Harlem, the neighborhood that we lived in was at the edge of Harlem, near Central Park. So Central Park starts at 110th Street,
right,
and then from 110th Street on, going up in the numbers, that was Harlem. There were white people living in our neighborhood in that, you know, during that period of time,
right.
And then probably by the 50s, everybody had moved out.
Really.
And now they're moving back. They're back.
Right. They're back because real estate is premium.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What was it like living there at that time and kind of going to high school and looking at opportunities?
The situation was, I mean, you know, If you think of the upbringing of a child, you know, a child's existence or their understanding of the world, the universe, is based on what they see every day.
Right.
So my universe was Harlem. The environment that existed in Harlem at that potential point in time, most of the adults I knew were working in kind of menial jobs and whatnot. The authority figures I encountered tended to be white. Most of the teachers were white. Policemen were white. Store owners were white. So my view of, what are my possibilities was sort of constrained and modified by that type of environment. It was only when I went into the service and then, went to North Carolina, which for a black person is not a great place at that point in time, was not a great place to be.
Right.
You know, there was the colored entrance, the white entrance, and so on and so on.
And they didn't have that kind of thing in New York?
Well, there weren't signs. I mean, there was just a tacit understanding of certain places you just wouldn't go to. If you're talking about the subway, the buses, and things like that, they were all integrated. You could sit on any seat in the bus.
Right.
You could... public transportation was integrated. In the South, it wasn't.
When you got down to North Carolina, that was when you...
Well, that
was a little bit more blatant?
Oh, it was obviously blatant. You know, right. We took a bus, we took a bus to North Carolina and got off the bus, and then there was the colored entrance and the white entrance. The colored entrance was off to the side, and the white entrance, was the entrance. If you wanted to buy something in the restaurant at the bus station, you had to go off to the side and look in the window and hope to get someone's attention before you could, order anything. Of course, you couldn't eat in the restaurant, anything like that. So that was a shock. I mean, that was, quite an experience. But, typically I spent most of my time on the base. And then there were areas where the blacks hung out. And the areas where the whites hung out. So, I mean, it's total segregation.
So you were, 17, 18?
Well, I went into the service, I graduated high school at 17. Yeah, young age.
Yeah.
Didn't know what I wanted to do. My older brother went into a college preparatory curriculum, so I did the same thing. And so I graduated with the background to go directly into college, but not really a sense of purpose. So, I had various jobs and then decided that this was not
right.
the environment that I wanted to sort of spend my time in. And I thought of the service as an opportunity for me to go in, potentially get a trade or something like that. And once I was in the service, and the other thing is, you know, find out what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Right.
So once I was in the service, you know, I started taking some college-level classes and, you know, hanging out with everyone. It kind of opened my eyes as to, you know, my potential, so to speak.
Okay. What service did you go
to? I was in the Army. Mm-hmm. I had the exciting job of being a switchboard operator in a battalion, but it happened to be a paratrooper battalion. So I had the pleasure of jumping out of airplanes on occasion.
Oh, that's nice. What year?
It was in 1957.
That was in between Korean War.
Yeah, I guess I was fortunate in that respect. The Korean War had ended when I became draft age or military eligible. And when I left the service, which was in 60, the Vietnam War hadn't really heated up. By the time the war heated up, I had been out for several years, and I was married, you know, had at least a child or two. So they never called me. And I also was in the process of going to college at that particular point in time. So going to night school and working during the day. I've had a multitude of jobs. I was in the post office, the customs agency, you know, a few others.
Right. And so where were you going to school at the time?
It's called the University of the City of New York.
What part of New York City were you living in?
Well, the part that has been gentrified, but it wasn't so much that. No, Harlem.
Oh, Harlem. Oh.
Yeah. Back in the day, it was not as nice a place as it's becoming.
Where did you get your drive for education and for learning?
Well, my mom was 100% in our corner, and she had to work every day and come home, fix dinner for us. And, you know, she was what you might define as, you know, as your typical wanting to do what's best for the kids and doing to the best of their ability what was best for the kids. So encouragement in terms of, now we read a lot.
Okay.
And back in those days, we listened to the radio a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess we just, I'm you know, speaking for myself, I was just dissatisfied with where I was.
Right.
And I knew I wanted something more than that. And I just had to figure out how to go about doing it. And therefore, into the service, took these tests. And they said, yeah, you know, aptitude tests.
Right.
So I took the tests and said, this is going to tell me exactly what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to be best at.
Right.
And
remember what it was.
Yeah. Got the answers back, and I said, "Well, what should I do? What am I best at? You can do anything.
Anything.
So
anything.
Yeah. That didn't help. Can I be an engineer? Yeah, you've got the aptitude to be an engineer. I said, okay, I'll be an engineer. And so I started taking classes towards. In the service, you know, corresponding right. courses and stuff like
what,
that.
What kind of engineering?
Initially, I wanted to be a civil engineer.
Okay.
And, you know, it's interesting. Once I went to college, I started to be different.
Right.
Of my group, the guys I grew up with, you know, like maybe 10, 11 of us, my younger brother and I went to college, and then there were another couple of people who went to college. And that was it.
Right.
When you're in college, taking your classes and whatnot, you're a minority then. You know, I've been a minority working in a white environment pretty much my entire work career.
Right.
As time passed, you would see more and more, I'd see more and more people of color than when I initially started. So, you know, from the token to something that's more
representative. Did you feel like there was some of that tokenism in the early year?
If I did, I ignored it.
Yeah.
It was my ticket, you know, out of poverty. You know, and, you know, I grew up in poverty. So it was my ticket out of poverty.
Right.
So, you know, a year before I was released from the service, I was sent over to Germany and spent almost a year in Germany, and then applied for college and actually left about 3 months early to come back and,
because you
and
got
start
into college.
College. Yeah.
So what was it like going to Germany? Was that your first time out of the States?
Yeah, and it was first time on a big ship.
Yeah. Oh, so you went over no fly.
Well, it was no. Back in those days, they had troop ships.
Oh,
and they
right.
put a whole bunch of people on it, and then they sailed us across the Atlantic. Took
so
about
that's like 1960.
Days. Yeah, it was in 1960. That they were still doing troop ships.
Wow.
So yeah, unpleasant voyage over and unpleasant voyage back. We ran into storms and things of that nature. But it's interesting. That was another opportunity for me to, you know, that expanded my horizons. And, you know, dealing with people who, you know, on the surface look differently from me.
Right.
But, you know, once you got to know them, pretty much the same. And, you know, so that was also when I was in the service, you know, my environment was Harlem, which is mostly black people, and then white people in authority. And then I went from that to North Carolina, you know, which is another environment, but, you know, did encounter white people who were my peers and, mm-hmm. you know, so on and so on. And then, of course, in Germany, you know, a different culture, but people are people. Mm-hmm. So all of that, you know, opened up or expanded my horizon. So instead of thinking, you know, what can I do as a career in Harlem or as a career in New York City, it became, you know, as a career.
In life.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Anything.
And then so, but then, you know, then it became a question of what.
So when you went to college, did you start studying civil engineering?
I initially started at civil engineering and then decided that I'd switch over and become electrical engineering.
Okay.
And then
that's tough.
Yeah.
That's real tough.
Well, I was taking courses, and, you know, then about that time, which would be 62, 63, mm-hmm. you know, that's when computers, they actually didn't have any courses in computer science.
Really?
They didn't have a computer science degree, and they didn't, I mean, they had courses in computer science, but it wasn't programming courses and maybe theory of computing, but it was more related to engineering, electrical engineering and transistors and all of that. So it wasn't a discipline as you might think of
right
now. You know, as an aside, computers back then were actually they were electronic adding machines. You do punch cards, and right. that would, you know, put in the instructions for whatever the process was that you were going to do, just let it go. And
so you went to school, started one program, decided to move to electrical engineering, but you were also looking at this
new industry computers.
New industry.
And then I switched from electrical engineering to math because, you know, math was more related to the computer area.
Right.
And since I was going to go into computers, you know, I didn't see the necessity of getting an electrical engineering degree since I wasn't going to work in it. So I transferred to a major that I can get most credit for in terms of the classes right. that I took, you know. Yeah, graduated with a math degree.
And so you graduated from college in the early 60s. What did you think you were going to do, and how did you...
Before I received my degree, I had the opportunity to start working with IBM as a computer operator.
Really?
So, and the guy who hired me said that he knew I was taking classes and going towards a degree. He said, you know, once you get your degree, will make you a systems engineer, which is a programmer analyst type. You go and talk to your customers, what's your problem?
Right.
And then you understand their problem and you translate their problem into a computer, an approach that could be handled by computers. That was the direction that I was moving in at that point in time.
How did you get hooked into IBM? How did you meet this fellow that hired you? Did you apply?
If you think back to those years, this is 60, 62, 63, 64, you know, what was happening mm-hmm. back there? It's the civil rights movement.
Right.
And pressure was being placed on government, on companies to do, you know, to do more, so to speak.
Diversify the workforce.
Yeah, diversify the workforce.
Provide more opportunities in different places.
And fortunately for me, companies were willing to do that, but you had to have a certain level of ability, a certain level of talent for that to make sense. And I was fortunate enough to be in a position where, you know, I was in college, moving in the right direction. So I was hired.
When you were deciding to go to school, deciding what career, you had a family, you had jobs.
Yeah.
And so you were working your tail off.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were making decisions about what you wanted to go into because you were interested in it? Or was it a combination or exclusively because you were looking for stability for your family or for career potential?
Well, I looked upon the computer industry as a, you know, it was, to me, it seemed as though it was going to be the future. You know, everything was going to be involved in computers. So from that perspective, it seemed to be an area that would offer a great deal of, you know, of opportunity. And then kind of working in that, I you know, I stayed at IBM for a period of time, and then I went to another company, mm-hmm. and then to another company, kind of weaving my way through.
Were you looking, you know, for greater opportunity? Were you looking for those opportunities, or did they just come?
Well, because you know, you were just being open to it, and then you know, in the course of your interaction with people and things of that sort,
right.
And additional opportunities open. So the way it used to work was that if you wrote a program, you know, you wrote it, you did your coding and whatnot, and then you punched cards. You took this deck of cards down to the computer room. They would run it through.
Throw them in.
And yeah. Then you'd get the results the next morning. If you had an error, you would have to find out what the error is, and then you'd punch a new card, put it back in. And nothing was stored online. So your storage was those punch cards. So people would have trays and trays and trays. And the bigger the program,
What kind of things were people using computers for at the time? What were some of the types of projects?
Well, they
were
using it scientifically, okay. For scientific projects. They also were using it for business, your accounting.
Really?
You know, you know, you want to update something, you key in, you know, Herb Pendleton deposited $400 into his account number, so and so. They take that card, feed it in, it would run into the program, and then the program would update. So, as you might imagine, it took a long time for all of that stuff to happen. Some of the first computers I worked with had tubes in it, cathode tubes in it.
Really?
Then they went to transistors.
So you've been basically trailblazing in your career choices since you got out of the service.
Yeah.
Because
I chased time sharing, and I, you know, as you know, I joined the company who's a brand new company in this area of time sharing. So you got stock options and all that sort of good stuff.
Right. Was that IBM or was that?
No, that was after IBM.
What were you doing for after IBM?
Well, I was initially a technical consultant.
Oh,
I would, you know, teach people how to use time sharing and help debug their programs and things like that. So it was a technical resource.
So you went straight to consulting. I love that. That is even more trailblazing.
The salesman went out and sold the service. Then it was my job to come in and train the users on how to use it, you know, educate them on our service, how you load things, how you program on our system and things like that, and, you know, help them debug. I didn't write many programs from scratch. I tended to look over someone's shoulder and kind of try to understand what they were doing and how to do what they wanted to do on our computer systems.
Right.
You know, then there were other companies. I went into many computers with Hewlett Packard and DEC. And
what year was that?
Hewlett Packard was in the probably in the early 70s.
Deep into your career in the 70s and 80s and 90s, did you help other folks get into the business or do any mentoring?
You know, I pretty much was, in a sense, kind of doing my thing. And right. I think that was probably characteristic of most of the people
in that area.
You know, just it's not so much that I've made it And, you know, I'm not looking back. It was just that you're so focused on making it. Now, since I've been up here, you know, joining NAACP,
right,
and doing the back to school, success in school,
right,
and
you were tutoring,
and things like that. You know, that
substitute.
That's when you know, I have a strong sense of, you know, how can I help,
right?
And you know, I've been trying to do that pretty much since I've been here. You know, especially since, you know, joining, right, NAACP and right, being involved in that area. But you know, I you know, have grown. I did go into teaching because I, you know, wanted to help kids,
right,
kind of get a sense of themselves, and especially, I mean, all kids, you know, but especially Black kids,
yeah,
get a sense of themselves, and, you know, and it, me in front of them teaching them, you know, gives them a sense of possibilities.
Right.
You know, he's there. I potentially can be there too. You know, you put yourself in the position of a kid. You know, you're looking out at the world. Your universe is what you experience every day. And if you're in an environment where education is valued, encouraged, you're around books and,
right,
parents read to you and all of that, I mean, that builds you up, and that that gives you a sense of what the possibilities are. But if all of that is restricted, I sort of see myself as, you know, kind of an anomaly in that. And I'm not sure if it was, I'm not sure what it is, but, you know, for some reason I was, you know, drawn to reading. I basically self-educated myself, and I really wasn't that interested in school. But I would, you know, not allow myself to fail.
Right.
So I would shine the classes until the end of the term and then study hard and, you know, pass. So, I didn't graduate from high school with a stellar average, but I did graduate from high school. I think, in a sense, there was an innate dissatisfaction. There was an innate desire to do more. I knew that I wasn't going to live the Harlem life for the rest of my life. And, you know, my task was to find out what I would do. And then, you know, I looked at initially the service as a way to give me some ideas, thinking maybe I'd spend 30 years in the service.
Would you recommend that to kids these days?
A military career, you know, it's not a bad life. I mean, you think about it, you can spend 20 years in the service, 30 years in the service, retire at, if you go in at 18, 20 years, you're 38, 30 years, no, you're 48,
yeah.
And then you've got a pension, medical care forever, and then you can start another phase of your life. 48 is young.
What about just somebody coming out of high school and going in for a little bit, at least to expose themselves?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an opportunity for someone to find themselves. Right. It gives them purpose. It gives them, you know, instills a certain amount of discipline.
Right.
And, you know, it's more difficult for them to fall off of to go off into the deep end and, you know, get caught up in the spiral of day-to-day life and, you know, getting a mediocre job. And,
right,
you know, your only prospect is to maybe to become a manager of people who work at mediocre jobs, you know, that type of thing. So, right, I wouldn't say that, you know, it depends on the individual. Everybody's an individual, and kind of depending on where their head is, what their thoughts are. In my case, it was the perfect thing for me to do.
Right.
Going into the service gave me the opportunity to think of, or to be exposed to alternatives. My thing is that when you make those decisions, you make them and then embark on whatever it is that you've decided to do. And you make decisions that you may or may not realize how significant they are, you know,
right,
how critical they are in terms of the way you're going to lead the rest of your life.
Right.
And again, my sense is that, you know, once you make those decisions, you need to plow into it.
Right.
You make the best informed decision that you can, and then you deal with it.
Right. So what is it like being 80?
I'm still trying to find what I consider productive things to do. Yeah. You, what would be perfect for me is if I had a job, making a, you know, making a little bit of money, doing something useful. And, you know, as long as my health is great, you know, I'm, the way I feel now, I feel that I could definitely do something productive.
Thank you, Herb, for talking with me today. It's been a minute since we've gotten together, so it's been great to catch up.
And now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank its contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing guidance and enthusiasm, to Trifoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza, and to That Supergirl for providing web hosting. Our producer is Kimberly Noel. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Christopher Mitchell. Audio engineer is Christopher Mitchell. HugeCast hosts are the amazing Adam Wendt and the delightful JoJo Jensen. If you like what you hear, please give us a review. 5 stars would be nice. And who knows, we might even read your comments during the show. So thanks for listening, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.